special quality that gives us some clue that, well, maybe it's possible to go beyond our own confusion. Okay? Whereas if our guru, you know, appeared with a golden body radiating light, you know, we wouldn't get inspired to kind of try and become like them. But we look, okay? And, you know, to me, I mean, I think if my teacher started doing all sorts of clairvoyant powers, I mean, to be frank, that doesn't impress me very much. I mean, you can levitate, so what? You know, how does that do any good for humanity? Yeah? I mean, even the Buddha, he got, what's the story? He got to a river and like somebody asked him if he could levitate, and he said, "I'll take the boat." You know, I don't need to fly across, just take the boat. So, I mean, so what? You know, somebody can levitate. Big deal, okay? But what I look at His Holiness and, you know, His ability. Like we were talking last night, you know, how He doesn't go on this poor me trip, yeah? And how He's totally with every sentient being exactly when He's with them, and how He doesn't get angry, and He has compassion even for the people who destroyed His country. That, to me, is a sign of somebody who's enlightened. You know? Okay? So that's the kind of qualities I look for in a teacher. And that, to me, is the sign of somebody, you know, who has great accomplishment, because that's what I want to develop. I remember one time, because I'm often asked to go speak in schools. And so many years ago when I lived in Hong Kong, I was asked to go speak in a school. And afterwards, this little girl, a real little girl, and she says, "I heard about this guy, Uri Geller, and he could bend spoons from a distance." Do you remember? Mm-hmm. She said, "Can you bend spoons like that?" And I said, "No. But I think that's okay, because it would probably just make other people upset if I bent their spoons." And I said, "I'm trying to work on being a kind person. To me, that's what I want to become." And she went, "Oh, yeah." Yeah? Okay? So when we talk about, you know, the form body, the emanation body of the Buddha, you know, we have to think about what it, you know, why a Buddha appears in a certain way, and what qualities we're looking for in a teacher, and what indicates, you know, somebody who has progressed along the path. Okay? And then, okay, so we've gotten to three Buddha bodies. Remember, you start with the truth body and the form body, and then the form body has the two subdivisions. Okay, you have the enjoyment body and the emanation body. Okay, now your truth body also has two subdivisions. Okay, so here you get the wisdom truth body, so that's the Buddha's omniscient mind. And you get the nature truth body, which is the emptiness of inherent existence of the Buddha's mind. So there's emptiness again. Okay? Then you can divide the emptiness into two. Yeah, if you want to get five Buddha bodies, and you get the natural purity of a Buddha's mind, that, in other words, the fact that a Buddha's mind has been empty since beginningless time. And then you get the true sensation that appears, you know, that has a Buddha has actualized due to their having actualized the true path. Okay, so there's all sorts of different ways to think like this, you know. But it's very interesting, because as we learn more about this, then, and as we think more about it, we get a much better understanding of what the three jewels are and why we should rely on them and what we're taking refuge in. And it gives us a clearer idea of what the goal of our practice is, what kind of qualities we're trying to actualize on the path. Okay? Because otherwise, we're not clear about where we're going on the path, are we? You know? And that comes back to motivation. You know, why are we practicing the Dharma? Do we really want to get enlightened? Well, to want to get enlightened, we have to know something about what enlightenment is. Because if we don't know what it is, you know, we're not really going to work for it. And then it's very easy for our motivation to practice Dharma to be what we call Dharma light. okay, or feel-good dharma. I practice dharma because it makes me feel good. You know, when I sit there and visualize Chen Rezi and chant, I feel good. So that's why I practice dharma. Well, that's the same motivation why you go to the gym, isn't it? To feel good. So, you know, practicing dharma just because it makes us feel good in this lifetime, it's very similar motivation, you know, for why you go to the gym or why you, you know, go to a movie or something like that. So that's not, you know, even a dharma motivation right there. So we have to kind of go beyond, you know, of course we all want to feel good, but we have to look at something higher, something more noble than just, you know, feeling good right now. Because the difficulty is, have you ever noticed in dharma groups a lot of people come and go? You notice that? You know, they'll come and then they go. And I think that happens because when people come, very often they have a specific problem. Okay, they're looking for some remedy for that problem. The Dharma gives you, you know, gives us lots of remedies for our problems. We solve that problem and then we're okay. And so there's kind of no more need to come, you know, to the Dharma Center again. But that person isn't understanding that they got rid of that problem, but there's a ton of other problems. Okay? So here it comes back to, you know, really having the aspiration for liberation, understanding what enlightenment is and aspiring for it, we need to really spend some time to cultivate that motivation. And to have that motivation, we need to learn what these things are. Okay? And so as our teachers constantly emphasize, Buddhism isn't just about coming in here and sitting and closing our eyes and feeling good. We have to learn what meditation is and learn how to guide our mind and, you know, do all these things. Okay, now that wasn't this all what I've talked about for the last hour and a half isn't what Anne asked me to talk about this morning. But I got distracted. Because we said the prayers. So when we said the prayers, you know, I feel like, okay, you know, we're not just saying prayers kind of la-la. It's, you know, there's some meaning and something behind it. So what I said was just kind of actually quite a brief explanation. You know, kind of Chandrakirti and Nagarjuna have written, and Lama Tsongkhapa have written, you know, text is big and... You have Lama Tsongkhapa's 18 volumes, you know. That'll tell you more detail about it. Okay, so now I better do my job. and talk about what they asked me to talk about. And I left my glasses in my bag. No, I think I can manage. we'll see. Add 2 cups of sugar, mix well. No, reading glasses don't work for me. Okay, so I was asked to talk about the last 2 outlines in the refuge chapter, the benefits of refuge, and then the points for training after we've taken refuge. Okay? Because she said that you went through those, but those 2 topics haven't been covered. Okay, so we will... speed along here. So the benefits of refuge and benefits of trusting our spiritual guidance to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. First benefit is we become a Buddhist. Now this doesn't mean I became a Buddhist. You know, now I have a new identity because, you know, I mean, there's no sense creating an identity out of being a Buddhist. And actually many Westerners, they don't want to say that they're a Buddhist. Do you notice? I don't know if this applies to any of you, but maybe. But many people, you know, even though at the center they may have taken refuge in precepts and practice and everything, but at work if somebody says, are you a Buddhist? They say, I go to a Buddhist center, or I'm learning Buddhist meditation. But a lot of people don't really like to say I'm a Buddhist, because then other people might look at us like we're a little bit weird. You know, are Buddhism and Hare Krishna related? And it's interesting because you get some people who just want to declare themselves Buddhists and make an identity out of it, and that's not the idea. And then you get other people who are scared to death to say, I'm a Buddhist, because they're afraid of what other people are going to think. So they're closet Buddhists. Okay, any of you closet Buddhists? No? For many years. Good. Somebody's honest. You know? And sometimes it takes something for us to feel comfortable at work or with our family to say, I'm a Buddhist. You know, it's not something we advertise, but to feel comfortable saying it, you know? Okay. But, okay, becoming a Buddhist means that we're directing our mind towards the goal, towards becoming the three jewels. We want to become the three jewels, okay? So that's one of the benefits of taking refuge, is that we're clear in our mind what we want to become, and that's what becoming a Buddhist means, okay? The second one is it establishes a foundation for taking all vows. So, you know, if you want to take the five lay precepts, or if you want to take the eight Mahayana precepts, refuge is a prerequisite to that. Why? Because in order to taking the precepts is following the guidelines the Buddha set out. If we don't have refuge in the Buddha, then why follow the guidelines? Okay? So even though the precepts concern moral issues that are general to, you know, almost every religion, when we take the precepts, we're taking them with an understanding of the ultimate goal of liberation and enlightenment, which is different than just abstaining from those actions without taking the precepts, or abstaining from those actions without having that motivation of, you know, wanting to actualize the three jewels. Okay? So this gets into the topic of the five precepts. Okay? Not stealing, not killing, okay? Not stealing. No unwise sexual conduct, which generally means adultery, but I think in our day and age, it means any kind of sexual contact which can be harmful physically or emotionally to others. Okay? So even if it's consensual, if it can be harmful to somebody physically and or emotionally, I think it still comes under unwise sexual conduct. Not lying, okay? That includes little white lies. And then not taking intoxicants. That's the hard one for people. You know, get so many people who take four precepts, but that fifth one, you know. Yeah. I want to drink wine because, you know, it's really good for my health. You know? And a drink helps me relax. And I've been smoking dope for so many years now. It's just part of my life, you know? Yeah. Or I don't really want to give up cigarettes, you know? I mean, come on.
Chocolate.
Chocolate's okay. We're safe. Okay. And they found out that dark chocolate's good for your heart. So, you know, this fifth precept, you know, we have to look at it, you know, and I think, you know, if you have a little bit of resistance to the fifth precept, check up your own mind and where's that resistance coming from? Where's that attachment to recreational drugs and alcohol coming from? You know, and what does it do to our mind and what does it do to our relationships? And how do we invent 5 million rationalizations for why we keep drinking and drugging? Yeah? And you know, the big thing we do is I don't abuse alcohol and drugs. So I take a little bit, but I don't get totally intoxicated. Well, what's the point then? I mean, you're taking the stuff to get intoxicated. So what do you mean? Oh, don't get intoxicated. Then why are you taking it if that's not, you know? I like the taste. It tastes terrible. You know? So, I mean, we have to check up here, okay? What's really going on in our... And then all these people, you know, they come and say, well, you know, I work in business, and in order to close a business deal, we have to go out. You know, we go out to dinner, and everybody drinks, and that's how we close our business deal. And I'm not going to close any business deals if I don't drink. And I go to parties, and, you know, all the parties, everybody's drinking, and if I don't drink, they're all going to look at me and say, are you some kind of, you know, prude probationist, you know? And so many people tell me this, that very often I have this image of everybody going to a party or everybody going to close a business deal, and they're all drinking because they think that the other one wants them to drink, but nobody really wants to, you know? And why are we so afraid to say, I'll have grape juice, you know? I mean... This is what I think is so incredible. How many of you have teenage kids or have had teenage kids? You know, what's the one thing that you tell your teenage kids? Don't follow peer pressure, isn't it? Don't do it just because all the other kids are doing it. Isn't that what you tell your teenager? You know, all the other kids may be doing this or that, but that doesn't mean you need to do it. You think for yourself. But what do mom and dad do? Everybody else at the party's drinking, I got a drink. I mean, mom and dad are like as susceptible to peer pressure as everybody else, but then you tell your kids, you know, don't do it just because everybody else is doing it. Come on, kids are smart. You know, they watch what we do, not what we say. They're not going to fall for that kind of stuff. Okay? So, I mean, we have to look at our own mind about peer pressure, how we just do things, you know? If you're still drinking and drugging with the idea of, well, it'll turn my friends off and they'll think bad of me. Well, what kind of friendships do you have that they're, you know, that you're afraid of people thinking bad of you because you're not drinking and drugging? And what kind of mind do we have that we're so afraid of what people think about us? Okay. You're not going to invite me back after I... Yeah. Right. And you can't take tantric initiation unless you have refuge. Yeah. Okay. Third benefit is we can purify negative karma very quickly. And you can see that because when you have refuge, you have a virtuous mind. When we have refuge, we take precepts. When we take precepts, we purify negative karma. Okay? The fourth one, we accumulate a lot of positive karma very quickly. And again, for the same reasons. When we have refuge, then we tend to practice the teachings. You know, we tend to keep the precepts, and that accumulates positive karma. And here's another thing where we Westerners are kind of funny. You know, we'll come to the Dharma Center and we'll talk about karma. And we'll all say karma, karma, you know, kind of, that's your karma. His Holiness says that's what we say when we mean I don't know. You know, why did that happen? It's karma. In other words, I don't have any clue. You know, why that happened. It's karma. So we talk about karma. Oh, yes, karma, karma, my karma, your karma. We have karma connection. Okay, we talk about it a whole lot. But in our life, when it comes down to showing that we really believe in karma, I'm not so sure. You know, like we talk about, oh, yes, generosity. We create so much good karma by creating generosity. We can have a whole discussion group on it. How much good karma we create by creating, by being generous. How much good karma we create by being patient. How much good karma we create by keeping precepts. We talk about it a lot. Okay? But when it comes time to give a donation, next week, you know. When it comes time to stop lying, well, I'm really saying this for the benefit of others. Okay? When it comes time to practice patience, well, I'm telling him off for his own good. In other words, when it really comes time to putting our belief in karma into practice, we waffle. Don't we? No, we talk. So much generosity is the cause of wealth. Okay. But then somebody's collecting money for a charity, we give $2. And then we go out to lunch and spend $30. And we say, I can only give $2 because I don't have very much money. But I believe in karma and I believe that generosity causes wealth. You know, somehow we haven't gotten it yet. Yeah, we haven't really gotten it. You know, or we'll walk past a homeless person and we have granola bars in our bag, but we don't give them a granola bar. Oh, I believe generosity causes health and giving food makes you create the karma to have food and, you know, good livelihood in your future lives. But I'm not going to give that homeless person a bar of granola. Huh? We got to look. We got to look. Anyway, I got to hurry. You probably want me to hurry. You don't like when I point out all this stuff, do you? It's very uncomfortable, isn't it? You know? Right? I know. Oh, I've got to... You're such good students. You have such a wonderful center. You've made so much progress. You meditate so well. Yeah? No, I don't want to show off. Okay, everybody happy now? Get the chocolate. Okay, yeah, fifth benefit, lots of chocolate. Fifth benefit, you can't be harmed by humans and non-humans. Okay? Why, you know, and these benefits, do some analytical Lamrim meditation on these benefits and try and understand why these benefits work. Why are you not harmed by humans and not humans if you've taken refuge? Does that mean refuge is like magic? Okay? No. It's because when we take refuge, yeah, then we decide to get our ethical act together. So we stop harming others and we start accumulating positive karma. When we do that, we stop creating the cause to receive harm from others and we start creating the cause to have pleasant experiences. So if we haven't created the cause for others to harm us, people can't harm us. Okay? Similarly, you know, the Tibetans are really into spirits. Does Rinpoche talk much about spirits? Yeah, sometimes.
It's not an emphasized thing, but for him it's clear that that's just part of existence.
Yeah, yeah. And it's something we have a little bit of difficulty with sometimes. But, you know, if we put it in a more Western thing, if you have nightmares, if you have bad dreams, if you can remember refuge in your dream, it totally transforms the dream. Or if you wake up, you know, from a bad dream and the first thing you do is take refuge, then that whole feeling from the bad dream goes away. Yeah. Or if you're feeling kind of nervous or paranoid or something like that, if you take refuge, it really settles the mind down. You know why? Because we're thinking of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and we're thinking of these noble qualities of generosity and ethical discipline and patience and joyous effort and, you know, meditative concentration and wisdom. And when we think about those qualities, our mind is happy. Our mind's peaceful. Okay, sixth benefit is we won't fall to unfortunate rebirths. Well, here's another one where we're not kind of sure, you know. That's like, well, yeah, I guess I believe in an animal rebirth, but me, I'm not going to be born there. Yeah. And hell realms? Well, if I wanted hell realms, I would have stayed a Catholic. You know? And then we get real confused because we become a Buddhist. And say, well, if I become a Buddhist, does that mean I'm going to go to Catholic hells? And if I'm a Catholic, does that mean I'm going to be a Buddha, go to Buddhist hells? You know? I mean, we're still thinking of the hell realm as some kind of physical place that you, you know, show your passport to. Yeah? No. I mean, we create our hell realms mentally, don't we? A hell realm is as real or as unreal as a human realm. A human realm is also empty of inherent existence. So is the hell realm. Okay. Seventh is, in general, our virtuous purposes will be fulfilled and also our temporal goals. And so, again, this comes about because on the basis of refuge, then we start to practice. When we practice, we accumulate good karma, we purify negative karma, we stop creating negative karma. And so that allows our temporal goals to be fulfilled. Temporal goals are the ones within samsara, and also our ultimate goals of liberation and enlightenment. Okay? And then the eighth one is we will quickly attain Buddhahood and make our lives meaningful. Okay, so that all of that is done on the basis of refuge. Okay, so I kind of hurried through these, but it's very good. Take some time and do some Lam Rim analytic checking meditation and go through these eight and really think to yourself, well, why, you know, how does this work? You know, kind of, because we can see the benefits of these benefits, but how does taking refuge actually bring that about? And if you meditate and try and see the dependent arising of how taking refuge actually can bring these eight results, then we gain much deeper conviction. Okay? Then we are speeding along. See, I'm doing my job. Okay, so then there's different points for training our mind when we've taken refuge. And so these are guidelines that help us keep our refuge pure and help us develop our refuge. And refuge, it isn't like an on and off light switch. It's not like either you have refuge or you don't. But refuge is like one of those light switches that you turn and it gets brighter. Okay, so when we first take refuge, you know, we're kind of, we got it on, but the light's kind of dim. As we continue to practice and our understanding and experience deepens, then our refuge deepens too. You know, and you really begin to see this over the years. Yeah. After you've practiced for a while, you really see, you know, how refuge works, and you get a feeling of what it means to have accumulated some merit and have that kind of as a foundation of your practice, and you get some feeling of what it means to have refuge as the basis of your practice, and it gives you a lot of stability in your life. Okay, so different guidelines for practicing refuge. First is, in analogy to taking refuge in the Buddha, we commit ourselves wholeheartedly to relying on a spiritual mentor. There's that C word again, commit. Okay, and this is actually quite important, you know, to commit ourselves to our teacher or to several teachers, okay, but to really follow the instructions of our teachers. And this is a hard thing for us Westerners because we like to do our own trip. Okay, and, you know, committing ourselves to a teacher doesn't mean we just sit there like a puppy dog going, tell me what to do. I mean, because you find these people kind of who go, who do I marry? Where do I work at? Tell me what to do. You know, I mean, relying on a teacher doesn't mean we become an infant, okay? But it means that we listen to the instructions of our teacher. What are the instructions of our teacher? What a teacher teaches in the Dharma teaching, okay? So to follow the teachings that we get in class. We always think following the instructions of our teacher means what our teacher tells us personally, as if what our teacher tells us in a group isn't Dharma instruction to practice. You know? I mean, it's true, isn't it? You know, kind of, if you say to everybody, you know, do your prostrations, do your 100,000 prostrations. Oh, well, he's talking to all those other people who need to purify. But, you know, me, my knees hurt too much. I can't do 100,000 prostrations. Okay. But if we go in front of our teacher and our teacher says, please, can you get me a glass of water? Get out of my way, everybody. The teacher wants a glass of water. He told me to get a glass of water. And I'm following my guru's instructions to get him a glass of water. Nobody's getting my way. Okay. So we really miss the boat sometimes. Does that happen? Anybody act like that? All those other people. Huh? They're the ones who are possessive and jealous about the teachers, not us. Okay, then in analogy to taking refuge in the Dharma, listen to and study the teachings as well as put them into practice in our daily life. Okay? So it's listen to and study, and put into practice. So it doesn't mean that you just come to the Dharma Center and the teacher provides the evening's entertainment. Okay? Because this also is very common in America. You know, we want an entertaining teacher. You know, and the teacher does all the work, gives a very entertaining talk, and then we can go home and forget about it. Okay, that's not it, okay? We need to listen to the teachings and then put them into practice. Okay, in analogy to taking refuge to the Sangha, respect the Sangha as your spiritual companions. Okay, so in particular, this refers to respecting those who have high realizations and to respecting the monastics who are Sangha. And this, again, this is difficult for Westerners, you know. Monastics, what a hierarchy. All these weird people, you know, they're just copping out of relationships. Yeah, that's why they're celibate anyway, because they can't, they're incapable in relationships and they can't hold down a job and, you know, they're just doing a trip, shaving their head and, you know, putting on robes and, you know, we don't want to respect them. Why should I make offerings to them and give them lunch, you know? They should serve me. They're the renounced ones. People think like that. I can tell you from personal experience. Okay? But the reason we respect monastics is not, we're not respecting, you know, and not all monastics are perfect, believe me, okay? But the reason we respect is we're respecting the vows that those people have. Okay? Because keeping ethical discipline is not easy. Okay? If it were easy, we would probably all do it. But it's not easy. So, you know, for those people who are making, you know, a more committed effort, then we show respect to them. Okay? And it's because the lineage of the vows from the Buddha, that's what it is. It's not the personality. It's the lineage of the vows that come from the Buddha. Okay? And believe me, this applies to the monastics as well, because we can have just as critical mind as everybody else. You know, we sit in order of our line of ordination, and sometimes when you have really bad critical mind, you look down the line and you find fault with everybody, and you look up the line and find fault with everybody. You know, and this is meant for us as well, you know, to stop that critical mind. That's all we say. But I'm the best of all, and you should recognize me. Okay. And then, we should train in accord with the example the good practitioner set, and we should avoid being rough and arrogant and running after any desirable object that glitters in front of us. Difficult, isn't it? Where's that chocolate? Okay. So to try and, you know, just not run after samsaric glitter, all the perfections of samsara. And another guideline is to be friendly and kind to others and to be more concerned with correcting our own faults than with correcting theirs. That's also hard, isn't it? You know? We think we can keep tantric vows. We want to take the tantric vows, you know, which are much more difficult to keep than these. Can we keep these? You know, are we more concerned about correcting our own faults than other people's faults? I mean, they have so many faults. And they're so noticeable. You know, I only have one or two, and other people aren't allowed to notice them because I'm working so hard to correct them. You know, and don't worry, I don't suffer from pride or anything like that. You know? I mean, look how we think. Okay, then the next one. As much as possible to avoid the 10 non-virtuous actions and to take and keep precepts. So actually, Anne had asked me about giving the 8 precepts. So I think in the future will come when I'm not doing a prison visit the day before, maybe rearrange it somehow, and where we can have like the, or I'm not flying on the airplane later on the day, but where we can have maybe like some kind of retreat or something like that, and then just do you know, the precepts for a whole day like that. That would be really nice. And then the next guideline is to make special offerings to the three jewels on the Buddhist festival days. So, you know, on Vesak, on, you know, the anniversary of the turning of the Dharma wheel. On new and full moon days, those are very good days to make offerings. And in general, it's good to make offerings to the three jewels. What did you give the three jewels? Buddha got some oranges. Nice. Some daffodils. Why do we make offerings? You think the Buddha needs oranges and daffodils? Buddha's going, I don't like oranges. Why didn't you give me some yogurt? We give offerings because it helps us to take delight in giving. It helps us to be generous. Okay, that's why we make the offerings. Buddha doesn't need them. Okay, more guidelines. And for those of you who are interested, if you can't remember them all because we're going through them quickly, if you get the prayer book, Pearl of Wisdom, the book one, it has all the refuge guidelines listed in there. Okay, and also in Taming the Monkey Mind, I think they're all listed in there, and the five precepts are listed in there too. Okay, so having taken refuge in the Buddha, who's purified all defilements and developed all good qualities, don't take refuge in worldly gods. Okay? So it means be very clear about what our object of refuge is. And, you know, don't think. I remember one time one Buddhist center was having somebody come to do channeling as a fundraising. You know, and all these people say, oh, the channeler said da, 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 you know. And people get really infatuated like that. I think that's, you know, our refuge is in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Yeah. I mean, it's the same kind of mind. The Buddha says, purify negative karma, do your vajrasattva, and purify negative karma. And we say, manana. We go to a fortune teller, or to have tarot cards, or, you know, Mohs, or whatever done. And that result says, purify your negative karma, and do vajrasattva. Yes, sir, right away, I'm going to do it. I mean, we listen more to the advice of the fortune teller than we do of the Buddha. It shouldn't be like that. And then also, because of taking refuge in the Buddha, respect the different Buddhist images. Okay? So we don't look at Buddhist images as just works of art, you know, and you know, this Buddha's really pretty, but that one's ugly. And, you know, I have this expensive Buddhist image, so I'm going to put it at the front of my altar so everybody will think I'm rich. You know, Buddhist images, you know, are showing us the enlightened qualities, and we respect them no matter what. And we should keep them clean, too. You know, sometimes we get a little bit rushed. We forget to clean our shrine. And we should keep it very clean. And it's very helpful to have a shrine, you know, especially in our crazy American life when we're all stressed out. And then, you know, you walk past the shrine in your home, and then there's the Buddha, and he's just sitting there so peaceful. And we go, oh, glad somebody's peaceful. Maybe I should try and become like that. Yeah, so it's very helpful to have a shrine. Okay, having taken refuge in the Dharma, then avoid harming living beings. That's the bottom line. Avoid harming living beings by what we say, what we think, what we do. Okay, and also to show respect to the Dharma, which I was saying the real Dharma is the true paths and true cessations, then the symbol of them is the Dharma text. So we respect the text. We don't put our Dharma books on the floor. We don't step over them. You know, you don't put them on the coffee table and put your coffee cup on top and your novel on top of your Dharma books and stuff like that. But really, it's a mindfulness practice, you know, and it's very effective. And then having taken refuge in the Sangha, don't cultivate the deep friendship of people who have wrong views and who are very much opposed to your spiritual practice. Because if you do, then, you know, we start thinking like them and we abandon our refuge. And so that's why the people who come to the center are very important to us. Our Dharma friends are so important to us because they understand that part of us And, you know, we can, they respect that spiritual part of us, we respect that spiritual part of them, and we help each other a lot in practice. So it's very important in this, you know, in Dharma centers, that people really respect each other and enjoy each other and help each other. Yeah, it's very important. Yeah, because these are our real friends, because they understand our spiritual yearning. Okay. Also, in analogy for taking or having taken refuge in the Sangha, then to respect monastics and to respect good practitioners. Okay. And again, this whole idea of respecting, it's because when we can respect the good qualities in others, then we open ourselves up to have those same good qualities. When we're arrogant and proud and can't respect others' spiritual accomplishments or spiritual qualities, then since we think we're big know-it-alls, we've already shut ourselves off to growing and learning. Okay? So, like, that's why we do prostrations at the beginning. We're humbling ourselves. Yeah, we're remembering the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha's good qualities, and we're paying respect, and that opens us up to develop those same qualities. Okay, so that's the whole idea behind respecting. Okay, then common guidelines. So mindful of the qualities, skills, and differences between the three jewels and other possible refuges, repeatedly take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So do it repeatedly, okay? It's very good to do this three times in the morning and three times at night when you first get up, before you go to bed. Start your day with refuge, finish it with refuge. Yeah, and that's why we take refuge at the beginning of, you know, all of our Dharma practices. We, you know, make that familiar in our mind. And then second is remembering their kindness, make offerings to them, and especially offer our food before we eat. Okay, so this is an important practice, offering our food. Again, in Pearl of Wisdom, Book 1, there's prayers for offering our food. Because eating is, you know, we eat all the time, so it's such an opportunity to create so much merit by making offering to the three jewels. So it's really good to do it. And it's also kind of a mindfulness practice, because we have to stop and reflect before we eat instead of just go. Yeah. Okay, third is mindful of their compassion, encourage others to take refuge in the three jewels. So this doesn't mean we stand on street corners. But, you know, encourage your friends to come to the center, give them Dharma books, leave Dharma books out for people to read. You know, family members, just leave it on the coffee table. Sometimes they pick it up. Okay, so encourage other people in that way. And fourth, remembering the benefits of taking refuge. Do so three times in the morning and three times in the evening. Shall we remember the benefits? We keep saying, you know, taking our refuge in the morning and the evening, and it frames our day. It's very good for us. Fifth is do all actions by entrusting ourselves to the three jewels. Okay, so no matter what we're doing, if you're going in for surgery, if you're getting married, if it's the worst day of your life or the happiest day of your life, you know, take refuge. Do it all by relying on Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And then sixth is don't forsake our refuge, even at the cost of our life or as a joke. Okay? So really keep our refuge very firm. Okay. So again, these are things to spend some time thinking about. Okay? If you think about them in relationship to your life, then you'll see all sorts of different ways that they can manifest and flow in your life, and it can be very, very helpful. So I spent the whole time talking and even went overtime. Do you want to do a little bit of Q&A, or are you too exhausted? Yeah.
Question is not really for everyone, but I'm confused about emptiness and then how that relates to reincarnation. I mean, if there is no
soul, what's reincarnated? How do you get reincarnated if there's no you? Okay. I like to use the example of a river. I just learned how to say it. Cuyahoga?
Yeah.
Did I say it right? Yeah. Cuyahoga River? Mississippi is easier. Cuyahoga River, when you look at it, okay, there's a whole long thing going on, okay? We use the term Cuyahoga River as if it's one thing. But what really is the river? Is it the banks? Is it the water? Is it the stones at the bottom? Is it the opening of the river at, you know, when it goes into the lake? Is it the water upstream? Is it the mud in the water? When we start analyzing and looking for a real Cuyahoga River, we can't find anything that we can draw a line around and say, that's it. Okay. But when we don't analyze, we use the term Cuyahoga River, and we all know what we're talking about. Okay? So in a similar way, when we look for a real solid person, something that we can say, this is me, we can't find anything. And yet, in dependence upon a body and mind, we give the label I. But there's no other I that exists besides the label that's getting put on independence, on the body and mind. Okay? So when we say, I get reborn, it doesn't mean that there's a solid I that gets reborn. Because in fact, if there were a solid I, rebirth would be impossible. Because if something is solid and truly exists, it's permanent, it can't change. And if it can't change, it can't be reborn, because rebirth indicates change. Okay, so it's precisely because there's no truly existent self that therefore rebirth can exist. Okay, because the I that's reborn is not a solid I, it's just what exists by being labeled independence upon whatever body and mind happen to be there at the time. Okay? So in the same way that we can't find something that's the river, yet when we look, the river's there, we can't find some solid thing that's me, but when we don't analyze, when we don't look, we say there's a person. Yeah?
So can you think of it maybe as like the transformation of energy that is reborn?
It's, our energies are transforming moment by moment, mm-hmm. aren't they? I mean, in one way, rebirth happens each moment, because the previous moment of body no longer exists in this moment, and the previous moment of mind no longer exists in this moment. Okay, rebirth is a much more gross thing that's happening, because this physical body goes into the garbage. Okay, but it's still this idea, you know, with the mind stream of one moment of consciousness begets another moment that is different from it. It's not the same moment of consciousness. Okay. Open Heart, Clear Mind has a chapter about rebirth that can be quite helpful if you want to go into that.